This time on your weekly Constitutional.
The framers' idea was to have a federal government with limited and enumerated powers and state governments with general powers to regulate day-to-day activities within their sovereign borders. It's true that over time, the authority of Congress to regulate day-to-day affairs of Americans has grown, just as the nature of commerce has grown over time. The system still leaves considerable room for state legislatures and state courts to operate.
That was Jeffrey Sutton, a federal appellate judge who's advocating for the power and responsibility of states within our federal system. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and this week it's about 51 imperfect solutions.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
This is a show about the United States Constitution, and so I guess it's understandable, at least I hope it's understandable, that we focus on that document, including all of its amendments. But sometimes we have to remind ourselves that there are 50 other constitutions out there. You heard that right. 50 states, each has its own constitution, and those constitutions and the laws that are promulgated pursuant to those constitutions are very, very important. In fact, as our guest today points out, the vast majority of American legal cases, the vast majority of American laws, don't emanate from Washington, D.C. They emanate from those 50 states.
My name's Jeff Sutton, and I'm a judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit.
Which is only one step below the Supreme Court.
That's right, and one step above the trial court, the district courts.
And before that, I believe you were the Solicitor General in your home state of Ohio, right?
Exactly.
Well, what do you like better, being a judge or being a Solicitor General?
That's a harder question than you might think. Maybe the most exciting experience for me was being the Solicitor General of Ohio. I really, really enjoyed it. But I must say, I quite enjoy being a judge as well.
Even though occasionally you get some pretty hard cases. In fact, weren't you on the panel that upheld the Affordable Care Act some years ago?
Yeah, I've had, if you're a judge for 15 years, you're bound to get cases all over the map. And one of the hard parts about being a judge is you ultimately have to allocate disappointment to half of the people that come in front of you. So.
Winners and losers in every case. Well, Judge, the reason we're talking today, of course, is because of your fascinating new book with a fascinating title. What is it?
51 Imperfect Solutions, States and the Making of American Constitutional Law.
And does the 51 refer to the federal government, the national government, in addition to the 50 states?
Exactly. So we have 50 states with 50 state constitutions and 50 state Supreme Courts. And then, of course, we have one national government with one constitution and one U.S. Supreme Court.
And there are a lot more cases at the state level, aren't there?
Yeah. By some estimates, 95% of cases handled in the country in a given year are handled through the state courts, leaving the other 5% for the federal courts.
And your argument is basically that we need to pay more attention to them, right?
Yes. The argument is that we need to pay more attention to state law, state constitutions, and state courts.
Before you go any further, Judge, and by the way, I really enjoy interrupting judges because it's something I never did in practice.
Good.
But isn't this sort of an odd thing for a federal appellate judge to be arguing? Shouldn't I be getting a book like this from a state Supreme Court justice?
You might, and that would be a sign that I'm having some success in getting people to write and think about it. The book grows out of my experience as the state Solicitor General of Ohio, where I learned about the existence of state constitutional law. Indeed, I tell my students at Harvard and Ohio State that I could teach a semester-long course on state constitutional law based solely on cases I lost at the Ohio Supreme Court based on the Ohio Constitution. So The book grows out of that experience early in my career, but it's been shaped by my views as an advocate at the U.S. Supreme Court, an advocate in the state courts, and eventually as a federal judge.
Let's expand on that a little bit because, of course, there is that thing called the Supremacy Clause in the United States Constitution, which makes us typically focus more upon federal appellate decisions than we do on state decisions. Could you talk a little bit about the realm that's left to the states despite that Supremacy Clause?
Well, the framers' idea was to have a federal government with limited and enumerated powers and state governments with general powers to regulate day-to-day activities within their sovereign borders. And so, It's true that over time, the authority of Congress to regulate day-to-day affairs of Americans has grown, just as the nature of commerce has grown over time. The system still leaves considerable room for state legislatures and state courts to operate. You're right to say that the Supremacy Clause requires state courts to honor federal rulings. So if a U.S. constitutional challenge is brought to the validity of a state or local law and there's binding U.S. Supreme Court precedent on that issue, the state courts have to follow it. There's absolutely no doubt that's true. But it's quite often the case that the U.S. Supreme Court will decide not to recognize a right, or perhaps to recognize a right, but only in a modest way. In those two settings, it's quite appropriate for state courts to fill the gap based on interpretations of the state constitution for that state. So that's really the way it works. You have the opportunity with all state and local laws to challenge them either on the basis of the U.S. Constitution or the state constitution.
So in other words, the federal constitution sets a floor, at least in the context of individual rights. But if a state wants to offer more protection, say under the Fourth Amendment or under the Equal Protection Clause of that state's constitution, it can do so.
That's right. So, a way to put it might be a criminal defendant is charged with a crime and he responds by saying the search of his house was illegal and violated the Fourth Amendment's prohibitions on unreasonable searches and seizures. And we'll assume he was prosecuted by state officials. And it may happen that his claim fails because of a federal precedent. Nothing prohibits that same individual from arguing that the state search and seizure prohibition gives him relief and prohibits the state prosecutors from indicting him or convicting him. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. I would say you mentioned the floor. That can be a helpful way to think about it, but it's also the case that the state courts can even construe their state constitution to go below the federal guarantee. They just have to make sure they honor the federal guarantee whenever a federal claim is brought.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So they might have to dismiss a case because it does violate the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, but they could specify that it didn't actually violate their own state's equivalent clause?
Exactly.
Okay, so it wouldn't change the outcome of a case necessarily if the federal claim had been raised in that case, but it would certainly establish a contrary or at least a different precedent.
You're exactly right. Another way to think about it is just compare American law to American basketball. And if you're charged with a two-shot foul, the player who was fouled gets two shots rather than one, two opportunities. And that's true when it comes to American constitutional law. If you are unhappy with a state or local law, in most instances, there's a state and federal constitutional claim you can bring to invalidate the law, and most people would assume that two shots are better than one.
Mm-hmm. Very important part of our federal structure. In fact, I'm reminded of a subject that has been of great interest to people and that we've discussed in this program a couple of times, and that's the infamous Kelo decision, where the court, I'm simplifying here, but basically said the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, the Takings Clause, did not prohibit a government from condemning property, private property, and then transferring that ownership of that property to another private property owner, at least within certain contexts. But the court, the U.S. Supreme Court, was at pains to say that, the states were free to establish their own constitutional prohibitions of this sort of thing, or even statutory prohibitions, and many states have done so.
Exactly so. There's a section of the book that addresses Kelo, and it's really a very rich federalism story, because as you note, the U.S. there was a 5-member majority of the court in Kelo that said it counted as a public use to use eminent domain to seize a house and eventually convert it into a potential headquarters of a company. And it was not a popular ruling in some quarters around the country. And one of the things federalism allows is it allows states to respond and fill the gap, or what might be a perceived gap left by the U.S. Supreme Court ruling. And the Post-Kilo story is right, really quite impressive. You have several state court decisions, including one from my home state, Norwood, the Ohio Supreme Court, rejecting Kilo and then rejecting use of eminent domain in a suburb of Cincinnati. And then you have some other decisions. I think there's an Oklahoma decision. But one of the things about the Post-Kilo story is it's partly about state Supreme Court decisions and state constitutions, but that's also a story in which many state legislatures impose new limitations on the use of eminent domain precisely to avoid a similar Kilo situation in their state. So it's a very, it is a classic federalism story.
Well, you do something that I really appreciate, and that is that you tell several stories in your book. What's your favorite of all these, the First Amendment stories, Fourth Amendment stories? What's your favorite one in your book?
Probably the eugenics story.
Tell us about that.
I knew before doing the research about Buck versus Bell and the infamous statement that three generations of imbeciles are enough, and you know that it was an 8-1 ruling by Oliver Wendell Holmes, and joined by Chief Justice Taft and Justice Brandeis, dissent by Butler. I knew about that. What I hadn't appreciated was the many state court rulings before Buck versus Bell in 1927, all but one of which got the issue decided the right way. And so that really intrigued me. And one reason I wrote the book was that I think too many books about American constitutional law focus just on the U.S. Supreme Court and the U.S. Constitution, and too often the narrative casts the states as villains and the federal government or the U.S. Supreme Court as the hero. And there's quite a bit of support for that narrative. Think of Jim Crow leading up to Brown versus Board of Education. So I didn't set out to contradict that narrative, but I did think it would be helpful to supplement it with instances in which the states played a leading role. And that is surely the case with the eugenics movement. And in some of the other chapters, it's not just the states playing a positive, even progressive role. It's that there was really a dialogue between the federal and state courts for, in some instances, decades in trying to figure out the right balance for the right balance for our national right and the right balance at the state level.
Yeah, I think I'm probably guilty, as other people are, of focusing exclusively on the national constitution and the U.S. Supreme Court, especially in an introductory class in constitutional law. I mean, you've got so much to cover. And so, you know, we'll talk about Buck versus Bell and then very little of the aftermath. But there, and even in that context, which of course involved the involuntary sterilization of Carrie Buck, who was considered, as you say, an imbecile, even though it turned out that she really wasn't, there was a lot of follow-on after that, because since the court affirmed the ability of the Commonwealth of Virginia to do that sterilization against Ms. Buck's will, a lot of states did the right thing, as you point out. But then a lot of states didn't do the right thing and continued these sterilizations for decades afterward. I actually had the pleasure of interviewing Beverly Perdue, the governor of North Carolina, some years ago when she was actively trying to make amends for the subsequent sterilizations that took place in her state. And that's a long and sordid narrative. So I'm so glad to see you point out that a lot of states did do the right thing.
Yeah, and the part of the story, so it is a story where the state courts do the right thing before 1927, and there's really some wonderful rulings that are deeply sensitive to the underlying issues in the case. And by my lights, and I think most people's lights, they got the decision decided correctly. The one head-scratcher about that story is that after 1927, after the Supreme Court's Buck versus Bell decision, the state courts really seem to disappear. And in our federal system, that didn't have to happen. They obviously had to respect the U.S. Supreme Court's Buck versus Bell ruling, but they had no comparable obligation to follow that ruling when it came to construing their own state constitution. So it is true that several states amended their laws. Some states opted not to enforce these laws, but it still lasted about 75 years. And that's longer than it should have. And one mission of the book is to remind people that state constitutions can provide as much protection as the federal constitution. And when it comes to the involuntary sterilization story, they provide better protection. And we shouldn't lose sight of that.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week our guest is Jeffrey Sutton, who sits on the 6th United States Circuit Court of Appeals. And he's talking all about the importance of state governments and state laws. Stick around. You're listening to your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm speaking with Jeffrey Sutton, who's an appellate judge in the federal system. Now, he's written a book called 51 Imperfect Solutions, referring to the fact that we've got 51 constitutions in this country and that most of them are at the state level. 50 of the 51 are at the state level. Before the break, we were talking about a particularly disturbing case in the federal system, Buck versus Bell. It's among the most infamous cases in U.S. Supreme Court history, in which the court approved the Virginia eugenics program, pursuant to which a young woman named Carrie Buck was forcibly sterilized.
So you're saying that subsequent to Buck versus Bell, that perhaps some state Supreme Courts were, or in legislatures as well, were overawed by the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court had ruled that way and therefore simply didn't take up the cause at the state level?
Yes, exactly. And in fact, after Buck versus Bell, I think it's at least a dozen more states passed eugenics laws.
So the U.S. Supreme Court is a bully pulpit, just as the presidency is. And we've got to be careful not to to be overly influenced by that, especially if we're state legislators and or state judges.
We, as Americans, the Supremacy Clause requires us to respect the U.S. Supreme Court on all of its rulings interpreting federal law. But those rulings have no impact on what the meaning of state law is, whether state statutes or state constitutions. One goal of the book is to remind people of that reality and encourage lawyers and state court judges to take seriously their independent, indeed sovereign, duty to look independently at the state guarantees.
You also have an equal protection story.
Yes, that's true. The school funding story, that one is actually personal. I had defended Ohio's school funding system as state solicitor general and lost the case in a 4-3 ruling at the Ohio Supreme Court. That experience was one of the things that led me down the road to writing this book.
Could you give us a little bit of background on that case, please?
Yeah. So in 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court had a decision called Rodriguez, and the issue presented was whether the Equal Protection Clause required school districts within a state to spend roughly the same amount of money. The problem the plaintiffs were trying to address was the fact that you had some suburbs that were very wealthy and then therefore could spend quite a bit more money on the education of the children in that school district, while a neighboring district, which had much less property wealth, say, couldn't generate nearly as much revenue and therefore didn't have as much money to spend on the education of the children in that school district. And the Rodriguez litigation was designed to create some equality under the federal constitution between and among school districts. The plaintiffs lost Rodriguez in 1973 in a very close 5-4 decision. And the point of that chapter is to explore what happened in the 40 to 50 years after the Rodriguez decision. And it's really a fascinating story. The provocative question that's left by that story is whether the Rodriguez plaintiffs won by losing, given that the state courts and state legislatures filled the vacuum left by that ruling in so many very productive ways.
Mm-hmm. Is that what happened in Ohio then? Did your legislature step up?
You know, most states, you're still going to have people complaining about the school funding system, so I don't want to suggest there has been one panacea. But I think most people would agree that since 1973, the states, through their legislatures and their state courts, have made quite a few changes to their school funding systems, changes that have made them much more equal than they once were.
I know that you're a supporter of federalism, but I'm recalling as we discuss these things how irritated I was back in law school when I realized that I couldn't just learn one body of law, but potentially I had to learn 51 bodies of law. Is there an argument that we've simply made things too complicated for ourselves in this country?
Well, I understand what you're saying. I actually think, though, on reflection, it is the genius of the federal system. I'm a big believer in the Brandeis idea that the states can be laboratories of experimentation. When Brandeis said that, he was referring to state legislatures and the idea that a given state could set out on a brave new course to address this policy problem or that policy problem. And I still think that's a very healthy approach to developing new ideas and new policies, because it makes sense to try things out in a country our size, in one region or one state or a couple states, and then wait for the evidence to come in. And if an innovation works, you can broaden it or even nationalize it. I think the same thing applies to interpretations of the Constitution. I'd like to see a laboratory of constitutional interpretation where state courts are looking at due process, equal protection, free speech, free exercise of religion, and deciding what they think it means. It would be ideal to have a situation where the U.S. Supreme Court had time to pay attention to those experiments, pay attention to the lessons learned from those state court rulings, and in some cases, perhaps eventually nationalize an approach or an interpretation, and in other cases, decide that it's perfectly appropriate to have two or three different approaches throughout the country. You're right to say it can be inefficient, but one of the reasons the book's called 51 Imperfect Solutions is so often our constitutional debates are very difficult to identify one and only one perfect way to resolve the problem. When we can identify that, of course, we should adopt it. But when we can't, it's quite strange to insist on a winner-take-all imperfect solution rather than allowing many imperfect solutions to be used, given the possibility that an even better solution might emerge.
I think that process of experimentation is taking place even as we speak in a number of contexts, but one that comes immediately to mind is physician-assisted suicide, where the Supreme Court, as you know, declined to find a national constitutional right to physician-assisted suicide back in the Glucksberg case and the companion case, the VACO case. And subsequently, a number of states have authorized physician-assisted suicide, several of them, and they have now a 20-plus year history that other states can look to and decide whether they wish to do the same thing or not.
You know, it's a very good example, because it's also a very complicated policy problem, and you could well imagine some states feeling a little more strongly about this side of the issue and some other states feeling a little more strongly about the other side of the issue, and therefore perhaps allowing physician-assisted suicide. And to me, the most difficult issues are often the ones that lend themselves most to federalism and to 51 imperfect solutions, 15 imperfect solutions, God only knows. But it is strange to insist on winner-take-all approaches when the underlying issues are so complicated.
I'm going to give you a compliment, Judge. You often hear these sorts of arguments made in support of a federal system of government, but so sadly, so often, people are much more focused on individual issues. And so if they like what the national government's doing, well, then they're nationalists. And if they don't like what the national government's doing, they'll shout states' rights. But only rarely do you actually hear people making reasoned arguments that are not issue specific, which is what you do in your book.
Well, I appreciate the point, and it explains one of the challenges of the argument in the book, that for most Americans and most individuals, I mean, and most interest groups, it's quite natural to focus on the result. And if you care deeply about an issue, it's very easy to think what matters most is getting the result you want, as opposed to paying attention to the process by which that result comes out. And you know, there is no one out there who doesn't want a winner-take-all solution that benefits their position. And I think that is one of the challenges of federalism. No political party has supported it uniformly, at least since the Federalist and Anti-Federalist parties in the late 18th century. I don't see any political party on the horizon supporting it uniformly. And that is because we're more issue-specific than process-specific.
Mm-hmm. But process, of course, is at the heart of our government and certainly of our protection of individual rights. Well, one more story before we finish up here. Your religion story, your religion clauses story. Could you tell us that one?
Yeah, that's a just a remarkable episode in American history. The Jehovah's Witnesses is a prominent faith group, a minority faith group, but a prominent faith group in America. That was true in the 1930s and 40s. And in the 1930s and 40s, we know Nazism was on the rise, eventually led to World War II, and it became an era of a real sincere and understandable patriotism, or having been attacked in Pearl Harbor and so forth. And the Jehovah's Witnesses were unwilling to participate in the Pledge of Allegiance and flag salutes before class, and that used to be a requirement in all school districts, at least public schools across the country. From their perspective, that violated their religious beliefs. And the U.S. Supreme Court initially got a case called Gabaitis, and they said the Jehovah's Witnesses did not have a First Amendment free exercise right to decline the pledge. And in fact, they were suspended, in some cases thrown out of school. Sometimes their parents were in prison for violating child welfare laws. Within a very short period of time, the U.S. Supreme Court switched and announced the Barnett decision, Justice Jackson's wonderful opinion, explaining that they had a free speech right not to participate involuntarily in these pledge ceremonies. The other feature of this story that I really tried to highlight in the book was what I thought of as the indispensable role of the state courts during this period in slowly starting to recognize these rights, and I think helping to set the stage for Barnett. And that's a part of the Barnett-Gobitis story that has not been told, and I wanted to make sure people knew about it and to give the state court judges who issued some wonderful opinions the credit they were due.
I'm so glad you mentioned that one because, again, I'm guilty of doing that. You talk about Gobitis and then you talk about Barnett and you highlight that absolutely wonderful language. And by the way, I think that's my favorite passage in the entire Supreme Court canon, where he talks about there's no such thing as orthodoxy in the United States, political orthodoxy or other orthodoxies as well that the government can impose upon us. Ringing language, wonderful language by arguably the best writer in Supreme Court history. But then you just go from one to the other and you might speculate on why did this justice change his mind or that justice or all the rest of it. But as you point out, maybe one of the reasons they changed their mind is because all these state governments started moving in the opposite direction.
Exactly. I think it really helped set the stage in word and deed for Barnett, and it deserves some of the credit, not all of the credit, but some of the credit. And that makes it a federalism story as well.
Well, Judge, before we go, any final thoughts, any summation of your position in your book or what you want people to get out of it?
No, I think the last, you know, maybe just to reiterate in a slightly different way, in this country, as a matter of free speech, we believe very much in a marketplace of ideas, the approach being there is no orthodoxy in this country, and in a free marketplace of ideas, the best ideas will rise to the top and can be embraced. And a similar thing is at play with policymaking. And the point of the book is to talk about one other way this can happen, and that's a marketplace of an interpretive ideas about what our constitutional guarantees mean. Due process, equal protection, unreasonable search and seizure, they all appear in the state constitutions and the U.S. Constitution. And I'd like to see a healthy marketplace of 51 sovereigns all participating and trying to figure out the best way to interpret what's often very general language. And I think just as a marketplace of ideas leads to the best ideas, a marketplace of interpretation will eventually lead to the best interpretations.
Well, Judge Jeffrey Sutton of the 6th United States Circuit Court of Appeals, thank you very, very much. And one more time, what's the title of your book and is it available now?
51 Imperfect Solutions, States and the Making of American Constitutional Law, and it's available from Oxford University Press and Amazon and so forth.
And at your friendly neighborhood bookstore as well, no doubt.
And thank you very much, Stuart, for interviewing me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. One of the cases that Judge Sutton just mentioned is the notorious Kelo case from 2005. And we've discussed that case on several occasions because so many people are still up in arms about it. If you happen to catch one of those episodes, you know that Kelo said that the U.S. Constitution, specifically the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, did not prevent the government from taking your property and turning right around and giving it to another private property owner. And that just struck a lot of people the wrong way. But as Judge Sutton pointed out,
There are state constitutions, too, and state laws, and a number of states did react to the Kelo decision in ways that created more protections for property owners in such circumstances. Among the episodes we've devoted to Kelo was one recently where we talked to Professor Ilya Soman of George Mason University, and we'll just replay an excerpt of that one where he talks about the reaction to the Kelo decision.
There was a massive backlash against Kelo in the general public. Most Supreme Court decisions are only noticed by experts and quickly forgotten by all but a few people. This was an incredible exception. There was right away massive public anger against the decision. Polls show that over 80% of the public disagreed with it. People as varied as the NAACP, Rush Limbaugh, and even Bernie Sanders were highly critical of the decision. Even for a socialist like Bernie Sanders, this was too aggressive an attack on private property for him to stomach. And more generally, many people on the left said this is taking the property of ordinary middle or lower class people for the benefit of powerful corporate interest, and so they didn't like it. And obviously, many people on the right also didn't like it. In the wake of Kelo, some 45 states enacted laws to limit eminent domain within their state. That's a record. No other Supreme Court decision in all of American history has generated this much legislation in response to it. And also several state Supreme Courts said, you know what, we're not going to follow Kelo in interpreting our state constitution. Kelo might be the right interpretation of federal constitution, but under our state constitution, you're not allowed to take property from one private individual and give it to another simply on the basis that it might produce economic development.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today we're talking about the importance of state constitutions and state law within our federal system. Jeffrey Sutton, who's an appellate judge, we spoke to a few moments ago because he's written a new book on it called 51 Imperfect Solutions. Now we're speaking with Professor Ilya Soman of George Mason University. It's an older interview. We did it in a previous episode because it was so relevant to what we're talking about today. After the break, we will continue our discussion with Professor Ilya Soman. Stick around. It's a weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish our discussion with Professor Ilya Soman of George Mason University, who's telling us about something we've talked about before, the notorious Kelo decision. It's an example of the importance of states' constitutions and states' laws. In this particular circumstance, what the property owners were looking for was some sort of protection, some sort of limit from the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution that would prevent the state of Connecticut or the city of New London or its authority from taking property and giving it to another private owner. They were looking for some sort of help in that regard. And essentially what the Supreme Court said was there's no help to be given if you know, the Constitution's not going to save you on this issue, property owners. But state constitutions and even state statutes can essentially say this: thank you very much, Supreme Court. You've told us that we, under the federal constitution, may take property under these circumstances, but we are now going to voluntarily limit ourselves at the state level and say, no, thank you. We don't want to do that here. And indeed, we're going to hold that our own constitution, our own statutes, prevent us from doing that.
Yes, that's right. In addition to the federal constitution, we also have in this country 50 state constitutions. Each state has its own constitution, and the state government has to follow not only the federal constitution, but also the state constitution. And obviously, local governments have to follow their state's constitution as well. So there's a lot of times where the federal Supreme Court might say that the federal constitution doesn't limit a particular kind of government policy, but they might still be limited by state constitution. So,
and that's basically what the reaction's been then, is thanks, but no thanks. We're not going to do that in our state.
Certainly, right. In many states, certainly by no means all. But as I mentioned earlier, several state Supreme Courts have said since Kelo that under their state constitutions, these kinds of takings are forbidden. Other states have enacted either new constitutional amendments to forbid these sorts of takings or just ordinary laws which say that these kinds of takings are forbidden. All told, some 45 states have passed these kinds of laws or constitutional amendments since Kelo, though more than half of them probably only pretend to ban these kinds of takings, but actually allow them to continue under other names.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you about, Australia is what has been the actual on-the-ground effect of all of this reaction to Kelo? Has it actually resulted in fewer such condemnations?
I think so. It's difficult to precisely measure these things because sadly we don't have a national database of all condemnations and the purposes for which they're done. However, in some 20 states, there were in fact serious reforms passed that really did impose important new constraints on these sorts of takings. And as I mentioned earlier, several state Supreme Courts issued decisions saying these kinds of takings are either forbidden under their state constitutions or at least severely limited. So while there are also many states which pretended to reform their laws but actually didn't do very much, still in some 20 or more states, there has been important progress, and that has cracked down on these kinds of takings. In addition, I think there's been an intellectual shift that even though for the moment the Supreme Court says in this narrow 5-4 decision that these sorts of takings are perfectly fine, still the fact that there were these strong dissents and that there's now this active debate on the subject, that means the Kelo could well be overruled or limited in the future. Whereas before Kelo, most people thought that this issue was settled. It's never going to be reopened. All right-thinking people agree on this. After Kelo, you can't say that anymore. And I think there's a decent chance that the Supreme Court will sooner or later revisit Kelo.
You mentioned that some states only pretended to reform their laws and that they're doing these under other guises. Could you give us an example of that, of a state or a
Sure.
locality?
Sure. There's some 20 or more states which are like this, including even the state of Connecticut, which where this case began. And there's a number of different shenanigans that are used to achieve this result. But the most common one is to say you can't take property from one private individual and give it to another for, quote, economic development, like in the Kelo case, but you can do it for blight. And blight is defined so broadly that almost any property can be declared blighted. Under broad definitions of blight like this, such places as Times Square or downtown Las Vegas have been declared to be blighted. These are actual cases. So in some instances in states which have taken this approach, essentially you can do the exact same thing you could before, just under a different name.
But that's not even really much of a different name, Ilya. I mean, calling a place blighted simply means it's economically depressed and therefore suffering social ills. So when you take something because it's blighted, because you want to improve it, that's economic development. I mean, that's barely even changing the nomenclature.
It depends on the definition of blight under state law. Mm-hmm. In some states where the definition of blight is limited, you have to prove either that the property is severely dilapidated or that it poses some sort of threat to public health, like there are diseased rats on the site or things of this sort. In other states, on the other hand, where the definition of blight is very broad, it is indeed the case that all you have to prove or all the government has to prove is that there could potentially be more economic development in the area than there currently is. So that's very different from the layperson's definition of blight, but it is the legal definition of blight in all too many states. On the other hand, if you define blight narrowly, then something like the Kelo taking could not happen. If you look at the homes that were taken in Kelo, very few people could reasonably claim that they're blighted. They look like perfectly normal middle-class housing. Admittedly, the head of the NLDC, the private agency which did this condemnations on behalf of New London, she at times said, well, this is a slum and it's horrible. I frankly find it difficult to understand what it was that she was talking about there. I think the vast majority of people, when they see pictures of these homes, they may or may not like them, but they certainly look perfectly normal and not blighted at all.
Okay, crystal ball time. How long till Kelo gets overturned?
I don't know for sure that it even ever will be overturned. All I think is that there's a much higher chance than it for most cases that it will be. But if I had to predict, and obviously predictions are always iffy about such things, I would say there's a good chance in the next 10 to 20 years, Kelo will either be overruled or at least the Supreme Court will revisit it and put tighter limits on these kinds of takings than exist in the Kelo case itself. For example, they might require that the government actually has to provide real proof that the supposed economic development will occur. Unlike in the Kelo case where the proof was extremely sketchy, and indeed, as it turned out, to this day, nothing has actually been built on the condemned site.
That's 12 years. Wow.
Yeah, this was a very badly conceived project, and it fell through. However, you can't say that nobody gained from this taking because a colony of feral cats has taken up residence on the site.
Oh, my.
And they are the only regular users of it. There are also some feral cat shelters that some nice people have set up on the site, probably illegally. So you can say that certain structures were built. In addition, there is a proposal part of the site build a memorial to victims of eminent domain. So if that happens, there might be development of a kind.
I guess so. Well, Ilya, this has been fascinating. We really thank you for sharing this with us. Once again, what's the name of your book about Kelo?
It's called The Grasping Hand. Kelo versus the City of New London and the Limits of Eminent Domain. It's available at fine Amazon websites near you.
Thanks so much, Ilya.
Thank you.
As British troops broke through American defenses and descended upon Washington to burn the White House in 1814, Dolly Madison defiantly stayed behind and did not evacuate until a family friend was finally sent to whisk her to safety. In a letter to her sister, Dolly detailed exactly what the holdup was. "Our kind friend, Mr. Carroll, has come to hasten my departure, and is in a very bad humor with me because I insist on waiting until the large picture of General Washington is secured. I have ordered the frame to be broken, and the canvas taken out, it is done, and the precious portrait placed in the hands of two gentlemen of New York for safekeeping. And now, dear sister, I must leave this house, or the retreating army will make me a prisoner in it by filling up the road I am directed to take. When I shall again write you, or where I shall be tomorrow, I cannot tell. I'm Matt Dare, speaking to you from the Potter Studios at Montpelier with the Madison Minute."
All right, once again, we're in the Potter Family Studios in the Claude Moore Hall at the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. We're here with Emily Voss, who basically runs the place, right, Emily?
It often feels that way.
Emily certainly runs many of the educational programs here. And Emily is going to help us find our next contestant. Who's our next contestant, Emily?
Well, our next lucky contestant is Brian Backman.
Hello, Brian.
Hi.
Where are you from?
I'm from Las Vegas, Nevada.
And, of course, I must then ask, are you a gambler?
Only when family comes to town.
So, basically, it's like living in New York City. You only go to see the Statue of Liberty when mom and dad show up or something, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
That's what I figured. Las Vegas, Sin City. Is it really as sinful as people say?
I'd say for the most part, yes.
It really is.
Yeah.
Also with us is Jasmine McNeely. She is here from the University of Florida. She's actually teaching the seminar on free press. Welcome, Jasmine.
Thank you.
And you're going to be our quiz prof today?
I'm going to be the quiz prof.
Great. Now, Brian, I happen to know, because we're staying in House 11 together, Brian is kind of, I don't know, a show-off? The other students refer to him as Brian the Jerk. And so, Brian's a really nice guy. Give Brian a hard question. Let's give him a chance to show off.
All right. Morris versus Frederick is better known as A, the F-bomb case, B, the S-word case, C, the N-word case, or D, the bong hits for Jesus case.
This sounds like it'd be a good question for George Carlin. Because we talked about that. It's not the F word. It's not the S word. I believe it's the bong hits for Jesus case.
Final answer?
Final answer.
You are correct.
Jasmine, he is correct. Absolutely. Well done, Brian. Morris versus Frederick is one of the more recent cases the Supreme Court has issued on student speech.
And I always found it to be, in some sense, my personal favorite. tell us, what was this Bong Hits for Jesus thing? What was going on here?
So a school-sponsored trip to see the Olympic torch as it rolled through town. 18-year-old senior unfurls a banner, him and his friends, and the banner says, Bong Hits for Jesus.
which means what?
The Supreme Court spent a lot of time trying to define what Bong Hits for Jesus meant.
And didn't the young man himself say it meant absolutely nothing?
It meant absolutely nothing, but they were worried about whether there was a religious connotation.
A religious connotation or perhaps a pro-drug abuse
absolutely.
Message? Absolutely. So because Jesus, of course, would be hitting the bong, I suppose. One could interpret it that way. But what really got me was that this kid basically goes to court and he says, I didn't mean anything. I just wanted to be on TV. I figured I'd get on TV. Just an 18-year-old just being stupid. Now, but this is the key here. Now, it's a school-sponsored release, if not an event. I mean, the Olympic torch is coming through town. That's not a school event. But the school says, hey, everybody, you can go and stand on the side of the road and, you know, watch the parade, basically. And so in some sense, he's still under the aegis of the school, or at least they argued that.
Right.
And so their argument was that pursuant to the ruling in Hazelwood, they could restrict his speech. But what was their legitimate pedagogical interest in restricting his speech in this?
Well, I think the pedagogical interest was in the worry about drug use.
Mm-hmm.
So bong is not just the sound from a musical instrument.
Right.
It is, you know, a reference to marijuana or marijuana use, according to them. So they were concerned about perhaps he's promoting drug use, and that pedagogical interest is in making sure kids don't use drugs.
You know, that to me always seemed to be, in one sense, understandable. Obviously, schools are going to discourage illegal drug use. On the other hand, there is a growing and legitimate public debate specifically over the use of marijuana.
Yes.
Isn't that precisely the sort of issue we would want our children to be debating and talking about? What do you think about that, Brian? Do you think they got it right in that case, the Supremes, or did they go too far?
I'm thinking of, like, it's passed in my state.
Uh-huh.
It's legal now in several states. It's a school-sanctioned event, so it's like, you know, you're getting in a fight after you get off the bus, but you're still at the bus stop.
Mm-hmm. So you think the school was okay, was within its power, if you will, to regulate that speech there?
In this case, yeah, I think it was.
Okay, now I'm gonna go a little bit deeper though. Even if it was within the school's power, how do you feel as a matter of policy? Should the school be trying to restrict this sort of, let's just assume that the school's right and that this young man was in some sense advocating drug use or at least marijuana use. Is that the sort of thing that is so disruptive or so inconsistent with the educational message that he should be punished for that? Just as a matter of policy.
I think if we're trying to make better citizens as part of the educational process, then yeah, they're within their means to do that.
Very, very interesting. The man from Las Vegas wants to clamp down on drug use. I think you're attacking the entire economy of your city.
We have professional sports now too. The Knights won their second game last night.
Well, congratulations.
Wow.
To the Knights. All right. Well, Brian, congratulations. We got Jasmine. Jasmine, where are you from?
I am originally from Wisconsin.
So originally from Wisconsin, but now you are from?
I live in Gainesville, and I work at the University of Florida.
And you are a communications professor, right?
I am.
And you know all about the First Amendment.
Well, I hope so.
Right. And you are here teaching First Amendment law to a bunch of very dedicated public and private school teachers.
Absolutely. It's been fun.
And you're helping us now with the quiz prof. And these teachers are seated here with us in the Potter Family Studios. And who is our next victim?
Your next victim is Adrian Spurduto.
Well, tremendous. Thank you, Emily Voss, for finding Adrian for us. Adrian, where are you from?
I'm from St. Louis, Missouri.
You have a lovely zoo there.
We do have a nice zoo.
Yes.
Yes, it's like the second largest in the country and the largest free zoo in the country as well. You do not have to pay to go.
Okay, well, now that we've talked about important things, let's get to the Constitution. Are you ready for a quiz question?
Yes, sir.
All right, Jasmine, do you have a hard one for Adrian?
I do.
Okay.
True or false? Public schools can force students to recite the Pledge of Allegiance.
Ooh, this is a good one because we have actually had students in my elementary school ask about this, and we have their parents ask as well. And so I know that it is false. They cannot force them to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
What? You're supposed to be learning these kids some patriotism, and you're not allowed to make them stand up and recite the pledge?
And reciting the pledge doesn't make you a patriot.
Oh, my. You sound like one of those leftists.
I might be. No.
Well, actually, this is an extremely important subject. Mm-hmm. The Pledge of Allegiance, which most of us are very happy to stand up and recite, many of us get misty-eyed when we do it. It loses all of that when you force somebody to do it. It really and truly does. And this is an issue that's come twice before the Supreme Court, right, Jasmine?
It has.
In those cases, ultimately in Barnett versus, I think, what was the name of the school district? I think it was in Pennsylvania or West Virginia.
West Virginia.
And the earlier one was Minersville. Gobitis case, right. The first time the Supreme Court actually upheld a school district's decision to expel some kids and punish their parents when they refused. I think they were Jehovah's Witnesses.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that was a very controversial decision. It was sort of World War II era. People were into a lot of sort of forced patriotism. Very, very controversial, close decision. Came back a few years later, Barnett versus Board of Education, some of the most soaring rhetoric in all of the Supreme Court canon. But Robert Jackson, who didn't even go to law school, he read for the law, wrote, and I'm paraphrasing here, if there's any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it's that no official, high or petty, can mandate what is orthodox. Cannot tell people what to say or to think. And this was, a statement that goes to the very heart of the First Amendment. And he just really recoiled at the idea of forcing little children, or anyone, to stand up there and recite words that the state was mandating. So if the kids want to, great, but they don't have to. But you've actually said, Adrian, that you've had issues with this. Tell us about some of the issues you've had with this.
More recently, some of my students' parents want their kids to be able to voice what they feel, but in a way that is appropriate at the level that I teach. I teach fifth graders. And so parents have come and asked if their students could do that and that they wouldn't be forced or chosen to do that. And then we also had a couple students in our building that were Jehovah's Witnesses as well. And so that came up in other areas also, like birthday celebrations and things of that nature. But the Pledge of Allegiance came up in that as well, not having
right.
them stand.
And there are two big issues with Jehovah's Witnesses. One of them, of course, is the compelled speech issue.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is the religious freedom issue.
Yep.
I mean, if you force a Jehovah's Witness to take an oath, you're kind of doubling down and violating two, at least, fundamental constitutional rights. And you can't do that.
Can't do that.
So thanks very much, Adrian. You got the correct answer.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to our two guests today, Judge Jeffrey Sutton of the Sixth Circuit, who's written a new book called 51 Imperfect Solutions, States and the Making of American Constitutional Law. Go out and buy several copies. And Professor Ilya Soman of George Mason University, who told us about one very important case in which states played a prominent role, the Kelo decision. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.